There we go.
Okay, so this is welcome to the 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes teleconference for March the 30th, 2022. My name's Craig McKee, and I'm going to be the moderating things tonight. I'm going to start off by just calling the roll, fairly short list at the moment. There's myself, Craig McKee, Peter Ketchum, Carl Golovin, Greg Boyd, Frank Tolopko, John O'Malley, Xander Arena, Barbara Honegger, Fern Tishman, and Nita Renfrew. So that's who we've got. Hopefully we'll add a few more, but that's a good little start. So, yeah, now our first speaker is Xander Arena. He's been on our call for a number of years. I don't remember how many, but he's been on the call going back quite a number of years. He's a volunteer at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. He heads up the verifications team, and he's also an independent researcher on other topics. And for the conference, the Pentagon conference that just concluded about 10 or 11 days ago, it took place. Xander, I was very delighted that Xander could join Adam Ruff and me as you know, to make up basically a team that put forward the position that there was no 757 crash into the Pentagon building. So he presented some really interesting original research stuff that people had not seen before. And I'm not going to get into telling you what that was, because I'm going to let Xander do that. But basically what the effect, I think, was that it really, it added a whole new dimension, I think, to some of the things that I was saying that I had said before, and Adam also. So we were really glad that he was able to be part of that. And I would encourage you, and I will, send out a link to the stuff that he's talking about on the call. I will send out a link to the group so that people can refer to it later and sort of take their time and look at their leisure. But in the meantime, he's going to describe what his research was and what he found. And so I'll hand it over to Xander. Now, I should put this in lecture mode, so that means that we won't have to worry about, let me just figure out where they've moved that now. Okay, open. Oh, yeah, so here we go. We're going to go. So everyone is now muted, except me, and now I have to unmute Xander. Okay, Xander, can you hear me? And can I hear you? Oh, maybe I've. Hold on, Xander.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Okay, good. I had not successfully unmuted you. So, so I'm going to just hand it. What's that?
Oh, you unmuted, but I was placed on hold.
Oh, that, yeah. So I'm clicking everything inside here. And so, it's just a complete crapshoot as to whether I hit it right or not. So, yeah, so basically I'm going to hand it over to you, and you can tell everybody about what your research found and what you presented at the conference.
Very well, great. Thank you very much, Craig. I appreciate it so much. If for any reason my audio is not sufficient, please feel free to interrupt me. I would like people to understand what is being said. So you used the words adding a new dimension to the analysis, and I think that was the perfect description for what was uncovered. As a little bit of background for everybody, I've sort of intuitively known that no large aircraft could have hit on the Western E-ring wall at the Pentagon for a long time, probably since 2001. And as a result of that, have been open-minded to other arguments or interpretations of the events there in Washington, D.C. You know, my father at the time, he worked in D.C. He saw the building on fire. I mean, I heard everything that we've all heard, but the geometries of the situation never meshed for me. So I set out to work with Craig and help him in a presentation arguing that no 757 hit the building. And specifically, I did really appreciate the work that CIT did. I independently found the veracity of their work to be compelling. I found their testimonies to be quite interesting and the testimony of those that they interviewed to be compelling. And so over the years, I've always, been a bit of an advocate for at least that there is truth in what they've said, but I've never ruled out the addition of some other form of impact at the building. I've just been open-minded to individuals witnessing some sort of larger aircraft flyover or approach north of Sitco, to be specific. And so to cut to the chase, I set out to examine the building and the maps in the area, the plan view, the terrain, the surroundings, to appreciate where the Sitco gas station was in reference to these various witnesses, and just to kind of look at the situation with a fresh set of eyes. And so as I was doing that, I leveraged modern tools that are available to all of us, Google Maps, of course. Another really interesting tool for us is Google Earth. And Google Earth has legacy satellite imagery of really anywhere on the planet. And there are images of the Pentagon from September of 2001. And there are also images from October of that year and going forward, 2002. There's historical data. And Google Earth has very sophisticated measurement tools, which I have used in the past for 9/11 research and also for other activities like hunting and camping and hiking. And so I'm very familiar with utilizing these tools and applying various different skins to the maps, like topography and reorientating one's position and that sort of thing. So as I was looking at these images, I decided to plot the scale of a 757 on the building and to determine the specific approach path, which was indicated by the light pole flight path, which, as hopefully everybody on the call is aware, is what we're told by the U.S. government is, and the American Society of Civil Engineers is, the official and what the path of American Airlines 77 took. Now, there's another tool that is available to us, and it's a feature of imagery called alpha transparency. And alpha transparency allows images to essentially become somewhat transparent, so you can overlay them and overlap them and align them. And I took historical pictures that had been done by other researchers and started to apply those transparencies to kind of get the current mapping to mesh with stuff that previously existed. At some point, I encourage everybody to review the PowerPoint slides, which will be shared with you. And you'll be able to see that I have aligned the incoming airline with the light pole flight path, and that path is what we've been told has happened. And then, this is what is interesting about this new dimension of research. I went and looked at the only other evidence that we really have, which is the security camera footage, and compared the plan view of the security camera footage, or what would be the security camera footage, with the elevation view of the security camera footage. So the elevation view is basically what the security camera sees, right? The security camera looks out upon the lawn, and that is the elevation image. And we see some kind of object in that footage, and we see its approximate location in the footage. And because we now have the ability to look at the plan view, we can determine the depth of that object. So this is where it's a new dimension. By aligning the depth of the object and the location along the light pole flight path, we can then roughly deduce the length of the object. And there's a number of different ways to go about this. One of the key features that I kind of honed in on while doing the research was the obstruction of camera post A. So there are two camera posts, camera post B and camera post A, and camera post A obstructed the image of the aircraft from camera post B. And so there's another key feature of this research, which is called the angular field of view. So the camera looks out upon the lawn in the building and has a field of view of 75 degrees. Okay, so that's the total field of view of what this camera can see. And you guys, if you have home security cameras, you know, nowadays you can purchase cameras with 110, you know, wide angle field of views, 75. You can get all kinds of different options. This particular camera allowed for a 75 degree field of view. And I noticed while looking at the elevation image that the center of the field of view was at a portion of the building north of a protrusion in the structure. So along the western wall of the building, there is a very subtle little protrusion. And using pixel measurement, which is a measuring tool measuring pixels of an image, so it's relative to whatever image you're looking at, regardless of the scale you're looking at it, the pixels will be in relation to other objects in the image. And so I took the total width of the image, divided those pixels in half, got the midpoint of the field of view, and then located that on the plan view of the map. So that placed aligned to the center of the camera at the northern portion of this protrusion. And what that did is it actually rotated the limits of the angular field of view a little bit to the east. And in doing so, we discover that the location of this object behind the camera post is actually much closer to the building than I personally previously would have thought. It was actually shocking how close the aircraft actually ends up being, if indeed it is an aircraft, and if indeed it is a 757. So I set out to prove, could this be a 757? And I found that it cannot be. It cannot be a 757 because the length of a 757 along the light pole flight path produces an object that is too long to be completely obscured by the camera post. And it is too long by a great margin. There would be a substantial fraction of the aircraft pointing out from behind the camera post if it was indeed American Airlines 77, and that much aircraft is nowhere to be seen in any of the camera footage produced, by the way. So if you remember, there are three volleys of camera footage produced. There was the initial leaked five frames, I think it was five, BMP images. Then we got a motion picture released several years later. While doing the research, I discovered it was about 2 weeks after Charlie Sheen famously came out vocalizing dissent from the mythology. And so then the Pentagon released this other footage. And then mysteriously, still to this day don't know where exactly it came from, but some very, like, quote-unquote high-resolution camera footage showed up on the scene. And other researchers, Wayne Costi and David Chandler, have leveraged that footage to make various arguments. So I used that footage. It was the most recent available. I can't say whether it was authentic or not, but I just wanted to make sure that if it would work or not. And in fact, it didn't work. There's no way to place a 757 in that footage. The size of the 757 in front of the lawn would be monstrous in relation to everything we've previously seen. I looked at it several ways. I looked at it with the angular field of view located, you know, or aligned where it had previously been construed, and then I realigned it to the center of the building where it actually is, and in no way did I find that you were able to place the 757 along that path. The other thing that I learned from this is that there are some trees in the background, and when you're looking at the plan view of a map of the area, it turns out that those trees are most likely the trees in the distance along, I think it's the 395. They are not a little cluster of trees closer to the building. And they are not a little cluster of trees in the Clover Loop. They are, in fact, trees that are further to the south. I did a series of measurements looking at the objects in the background. I correctly interpreted the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in the distance. The heliport pad appears to be so flat or somewhat recessed in the lawn that you actually don't perceive it. But it is, in fact, it would be essentially right in the middle of the lawn. And the other thing that I factored in with this is the distortion in the camera. So the distortion in the camera is a barrel effect distortion, similar to a fisheye lens. Essentially, it magnifies things in the center of field of view, while seemingly shrinking things on the edges. Now, it's not, remember that we have a total angular field of view of 75 degrees. So with this distortion, you are not actually losing information. It's you're just changing the appearance of it. And so I want to share with everybody that I'm currently working on a more refined interpretation of this data with the distortion removed. So I've created some images applying what's called a pincushion effect to essentially remove that distortion, straighten out the building, do some other changes to straighten out the column, and provide a subtly more accurate interpretation. This does not change the findings of the research. We still do not have the ability to place the 757 in this camera footage. It does not fit. But I will say that the slideshow I'm sharing with everybody included a cautionary slide, which I want to reference right now because it is important because this data is going to change in the final analysis, and I want to make sure everybody is aware that I was aware of that, that this is a preliminary finding, okay? So I do still interpret it as a proof. This data can be verified by anyone. We can all go out there and make these measurements. I have found in my own experimentation that as you make subtle adjustments in the alignment of the field of view, as you make subtle adjustments in the amount of obstruction or the location of the plane along the path, the results are the same. You cannot put 155-foot aircraft in the security cam footage. It does not work. And that means that whatever that object is was not a 757, and that means that whatever is that object was not American Airlines 77. And unless there is some other footage that was never released, in addition to that, which I find to be not credible or possible, but, you know, who knows, no American Airlines 77s hit the building. And that is basically the extent of the findings. I do look forward to, you know, kind of pressing on with the research and getting a little bit more precise, because I think one of the really interesting things that we're going to get from this is the ability to approximate the true size of this object. Now, I don't know if this object is in fact something or if it was a fabrication from the start. I am inclined to think that it is something. Those leaked images in 2002 didn't really serve anybody well. If they were going to fabricate something, I think they would have done a better job. So my gut tells me that the leaked footage, or maybe deliberately released footage, I don't know, but that it did in fact show something physical. And if we can measure that, we might get closer to understanding what hit our Pentagon on the 11th of September 2001. So with that, I will turn it over to questions. Hey, everybody. Yeah, to watch the recap of it, because there was a lot of really great information presented by all of the teams. And so I think we can all learn a lot by reviewing it. Okay, no questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Hi, Bob.
Yeah, shall I go ahead?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure where Craig is, but I didn't hear any response.
Sorry, I was. I'm sorry, Xander. Just give me one. They've changed everything on this website, and so I don't know what's, you know, I didn't know what was happening there. I couldn't hear anybody, and I guess you couldn't hear me. So rather than just go into this Q&A thing, which doesn't seem to be working like it was before, we'll just do the questions kind of. We'll just figure them out. Like the old-fashioned way, you know, have a queue or whatever. So, yes, so to let's hand it back to Barbara. You were going to ask the first question, I believe, Barbara.
Okay, so everybody's off of mute then, right?
Everybody should be unmuted at this point, yes.
Right. Okay, good. Well, a couple of comments and then kind of a burning question. First comment is thank you so much for your research. I think that it's a major contribution. And I look forward to seeing the more detailed analysis and, you know, the Zoom meeting and all of that that we've been talking about. My first question is, and then I've got one other one. My first question is, if I understand correctly from the short analysis or summary you just gave us, the one of the two videos that you chose to use was the one that was from, I believe it's camera B, where the post obscured the image of what's alleged to be a plane. And the obvious question is, well, there's another camera that did not have an obscured view. So what was in that camera? Please tell us what was in that camera, and then I have, from your research, when it's not obscured.
Happily. I did look at both cameras, actually. And so in camera A, which is the one that's not obscured, we see an aircraft or object or something appearing in the field of view just on the very right side of the image if you're looking at it on the screen. And we see, like, a triangular tail-like feature. And so that is the backward portion of the object, and we can place it along the plan view of the map. And what I found is that the object is still a little too small. In the preliminary analysis with the distortion, it is a little too small, but it is close to what one might expect to see. It was subtle. Okay, so the differences became more pronounced in the second image, camera B, because the aircraft is closer to the building in camera B. And remember that since the aircraft is alleged to be flying in a northeasterly direction along the light pole flight path, that for every foot that it gets closer to the building, it gets closer to the camera. And so it is, you know, coming towards you, it should be, in that camera footage. And so the difference is exaggerated. I did see problems in camera A. In fact, one of the things I did is I would align an alpha transparency of an actual 757 taken from a lateral image. And using scaling features, when you actually scale that aircraft to the size of the object, the proportions just do not match. If I matched the width of the, like, the thickness of the plane in the alpha transparency, you know, it was too long for what was shown. I mean, if the height is not right, there's a number of things. But I will caution that my alpha transparencies of the aircraft are based on a pure lateral image accounting for the angle of approach, so truncated in that manner. But in reality, the nose would be a little larger and the tail a little smaller. And I just didn't have the software at the time, the last minute, to make those adjustments.
Okay. If I could try to repeat back what I think you've just said, tell me if this is incorrect. I believe what you've just said is in the the image, the critical image, which is frame 23, of the unobscured camera, that the plane is actually visibly, sorry, a plane just went over, I have to let it go, that the plane, or the presumed plane, is actually appears larger than it does when it's closer in the obscured camera view. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. It's not large enough to be an actual 757, is what I
mean. It's not large enough, but is it larger than, does it appear to be larger in the unobscured frame 23 than in the obscured frame 23? I think that's what you said.
Well, I didn't directly say that, but the implication is such that I think you're actually correct in saying that, because the scale of the object in the Pentagon footage remains the same. But in reality, since the aircraft is closer to the camera and the building in the camera B footage, it should in fact appear larger. So,
but it doesn't.
Yeah, means that the proportions seem a little bit off.
Okay, thank you. So I did understand that correctly. I look forward to the more detailed analysis. And the last question is, I believe when you and I spoke, you know, after the conference, if my understanding again was correct, that when you do further analysis, we hope to be able to determine hopefully, one of two things. If we are able to determine the size of the object, or assume that we know it better, then we will be able to know, if we assume it's on the official story south approach path, then we will be able to determine the actual size of the object. However, if it's too small, it could actually be closer, or if it's too large, it could actually be further away, correct?
Okay. We have to make some assumptions. If the approach path is not in fact along the light pole flight path, in other words, if the light poles were taken down or knocked down or placed, right, if they weren't actually collided, and then we do not know the true angle of approach, then we could not accurately determine the true length of the object, because we wouldn't, you know, they would be very fuzzy approximations.
Well, yes, but there's another approach path. There's the north approach path. If we assume a north approach path where the plane just before the wall goes to the right or the north, or excuse me, the left
That's
or
correct.
The north of the clover leaf, if you assume that approach path, then the plane would have to be much smaller than a 757.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. If we can assume that approach path, we can apply it, and then we can make measurements. And I think
That's what I hope you do for both my analysis and position, and also Craig's.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we would just caveat it would be an assumption, but we could derive a measurement. I think probably within an accuracy of a scale of probably at least within 10 feet. Of total length, you know, and maybe that for you know, the larger one on the light pole flight path
you
as well.
You mean smaller? You mean it would have to be smaller length of at least?
No, like a margin of error of roughly about 10 feet.
Oh, 10%, not feet. I understand.
Well,
yeah.
No, I was using the word feet. I'm using the word feet. I think, you know, whatever the total percentage is, I don't know. But I think we can probably refine it down to about that level of detail.
Yeah, I hope we can. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob.
Great. Is there, since we don't have the usual kind of cue here, would someone else like to ask a question?
And everybody, please feel free. There are no bad questions. So if you don't quite understand the geometry or want me to re-explain, I am happy to. You know, I'm used to working with angles and folds and other kinds of things. And, you know, one thing, Craig, real fast, for us, it's kind of fun. One of my passions has always been origami. I'm a published origami artist. I have a book out there of created models. I've been folding my whole life. I have very complex designs out there. And when doing origami, you know, you're always aligning creases and aligning angles and using angle bisectors. And so this process of kind of delineating angles and crease intersections or flight path intersections, I could say, along a plan view of a map was really intuitive. It was actually very easy for me to kind of get my mind into this and feel quite confident with the solutions that I was driving. So anyways, yeah, please ask any questions you like.
Well, while we're seeing if anybody else, I'm going to ask you one, Xander. And I don't know if this doesn't necessarily, it's maybe indirectly related to the research you did. And I think it's something I mentioned to you personally, but based on, you know, various accounts, various witness accounts and the alleged damage, you know, the damage that appears to have been caused to light poles or, you know, by seemingly from a plane impact. You know, we don't know that that was actually the case, but based on, you know, the altitude, I guess, that people described, you know, people were not talking about something that was, you know, taking the tops off of cars as it was, you know, over the last several seconds of its flight. I wondered if you could just comment on the fact that, you know, the plane would have to have at least been at least a certain distance off the ground, and yet in the images that you were analyzing, it appears to be almost at ground level and flying like level to the ground. I wonder if you see that whether it is or isn't possible for, let's say that was, you know, let's just say hypothetically that's the 757. That is a 757. Can you imagine that it would be, you know, 50, 100 feet off the ground a few seconds earlier, and actually that it would clip the tops of light poles, you know, not more than a second before it appeared in your frame of view? Is it possible that that plane could get down to ground level and be traveling parallel to the ground for those last couple of seconds? What do you think about that?
That's a great question. I don't see how it's possible at all. The downed light poles are just outside of the field of view of this camera, and they're outside of the field of view of camera by barely the length of a 757 alone. I think it might. I haven't done the measurement, but I think it's under 150 feet. And I just don't see it's possible that the aircraft traveling at 540 something miles per hour could have descended 30 or even 20 feet in 150 feet. I don't think that's possible, Craig. I could see the light pole flight path maybe working if the aircraft were low to the ground, but there are trees in the way. The light poles weren't impacted low to the ground, and I don't see that that's possible. And I want to throw a little shout out to Adam Ruff, who was also in a presentation, because he also made the stellar analysis that when you look at the impact gouge or whatnot in the generator, that is also just before the wall, and where opposition to our argument says this large aircraft impacted the building, there's also no way that the plane could have descended that much from where it impacted the generator. So he noticed that. You're pointing out these light poles. Yeah, I don't see that there's any way you can fit a 757 into this equation.
Yeah, we'll go right to it. Give me 2 seconds. I just want to point out, I don't know, you know, not everybody maybe has followed the minute details, you know, of the Pentagon evidence as closely as you and I have and Barbara has. So just for those, this, you know, the generator trailer, I think what you're describing is the what is supposed to have happened is the right engine of the plane is supposed to have hit the top corner of the generator trailer, which I gather would be, I looked at it and I figured it's at least 7 feet off the ground. I don't know. You can tell me. But the left engine at the same time is supposed to have basically brushed against the ground and taken a chunk out of a retaining wall that in photographs that I've seen, it looks like it just pokes up, you know, not more than a foot above the graph. So you're talking about, yeah, quite a difference in terms of the height of the right engine versus the height of the left engine. And I, you know, I'm going to get you to comment on this in a second, but what I find interesting is that, you know, the right wing is supposed to have hit in large part on the second floor of the building, and yet it is the ground floor where the damage seems to be, and the second floor damage seems to be much, much less. So if I could just sort of get you to maybe just comment on what I'm saying, your point being that it wouldn't have had time to get low enough between the generator trailer and the wall. And I'm saying that also on top of that, I'm saying that it had it followed that the path that's being described, either the wing would have been snapped right off, which is what I think most people would think would have happened, or there should have been a lot more damage up on the second floor from the right wing, not a hole on the first floor below where the wing would have hit. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, I concur. We're saying the same thing, basically. If I'm being favorable to the official story, and I imagine that this wing, you know, basically kind of disappeared into the building and the second floor, then what they want us to believe is that this very large, heavy engine with an enormous amount of momentum and durability slid in underneath the second floor slab. And there's no way that it had time to descend enough to slide into that slab if it also created the gouge in the generator, which I think is probably a little higher than 7 feet, but, you know, close.
Mm.
We're in the range there. But that engine has to be to tuck itself underneath the second floor slab. I mean, it basically has to be just above the ground. And so now you're saying it's got to lose, you know, 3, 4, 5 feet, you know, something like that. Over the distance of, 30 feet. Yeah, there's no way to do it. You can't explain it into that equation.
I think that I was doing what you try to do, which is if you're going to err on one side, err on the side of not making too much of a claim. Like, make sure you're not. And when I said 7 feet, I was thinking, maybe it is eight feet or 9 feet.
Right.
But just to be really conservative, you know.
Yep.
I was saying a bit less, but yes, I think yes, that's exactly how I see it. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, and you can correct me or Barbara can correct me, it seems to me that we saw a diagram from the Chandler-Costi pair that showed the plane sort of just kind of squeezing mainly under the second floor slab, but kind of, again, perfectly, like almost like it's sliding into a slot.
Within the first floor. Ridiculous.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, is that it has to do that, because otherwise the second floor slab would have been decimated by this engine. So the only way their version works is if it gets into that slot. And yeah, it can't happen because there's not enough room for it to descend while they also wanted to have impacted this generator. And you know, now the length is wrong, that's wrong. There's so many things that are wrong on this. And Craig, thanks for mentioning it. I wanted to say to everybody that I did, in all instances with these measurements, I tried to be as favorable to the official story as possible. You know, there's no part of any of this 9/11 truth stuff that is, you know, really comfortable for anybody. And, you know, it would be amazing if, as an American, you know, all this actually worked out. And approaching 9/11 truth, I have always tried to trust or verify the information given to us and to see if it works. And in this case, it does not work. And so the measurements, I always leaned, if there was a margin of error, I leaned towards the official story in every instance. And then just, you know, it does not work.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
There you go.
This is actually a better opportunity to use that than O.J. Simpson's trial.
And just like O.J. Simpson, Bush and Cheney are still looking for the real killer, right?
Yeah. That was a moment on Saturday Night Live where they show a picture of O.J. Simpson playing golf, and I think it was Norm MacDonald says, "The hunt for the killer goes on." Well, he's playing golf.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm glad I got one of the questions I meant to ask, if I could ask it.
Absolutely. Do I have a moment to add one other thing to my my spiel here?
Yeah. Xander, there's something wrong with or going on with your audio. It's like there's squeaks repeated. Are you on a speakerphone by any chance?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Oh, it would be good to go off if you could.
Yeah.
Okay, I will try that. Thank you for.
That's so much fun. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Apologies. Yeah. Thank you for letting me know, guys. So the thing that I wanted to add was, you know, people undoubtedly died in the building. We lost a great number of good civil servants, contractors, Department of Defense personnel, service members died senselessly that day in our Pentagon. And, you know, one of the reasons that we know this is the DMORT data, or apart from just the loss of family members.
Xander, you need to speak up. It's hard to hear you.
Okay. When I was looking at the DMORT data, which is basically the mortuary analysis of victims, you know, and DNA and forensics and stuff, I was trying to wrap my mind around how it would be possible to have alleged victim data from this large aircraft if no large aircraft impacted the building. And what I found that was so curious was that the evidence of fatalities was processed off-site. So samples of tissue and dental records and fingerprints and other sorts of things were all sent to professionals at a secondary facility. Now, those individuals who were then analyzing that data were removed from the crime scene. So they would have to take upon faith that the dental records they were receiving did in fact come from an individual discovered at this other location. And they would have no way of knowing truly whether that did happen or not, what the location of that stuff, whether, for instance, if you're looking at teeth records, you don't know if the picture of the x-ray of the teeth is from or a dead person. You don't know if the fingerprints were from a live person or dead person, and you may not know if the DNA was from a live person or a dead person. If you're provided that sample and you're told it came from a body, you as a professional would probably assume it came from a body, and you would make a comparison to a prior record, and you would say, yes, this person must have died there. So it would be very easy, unfortunately, to fool a large amount of qualified, capable, patriotic Americans. And they may not have known the true nature of some of the samples that they were receiving. Because if no 757 hit the building, then American Airlines 77 went somewhere else. And, yeah. And so I can see how it would be possible to arrange this crime scene in a manner that a few people would be involved and a great many people persuaded or fooled by what they were told.
Yeah, you just cut out really low, so we couldn't hear that last phrase.
Yeah, we just missed the last there. I want to I just want to mention. I'm sure you have another question, Barb, but I want to just make sure that the other people that that we make sure that there's nobody that's been sort of patiently waiting, and then we can go to another one from you. But
I'd like to
finish that sentence again?
Well, I'd like to comment.
Okay, yeah, no, go ahead, Barb. If you want, yeah, by all means.
I'd like to comment on what Xander just said. Absolutely. And the official Pentagon autopsy did not find any Semitic/Arab DNA, which allegedly there should have been 5 alleged hijackers, right? Okay, that's number one. And number two, confirming what you just, your analysis, we know that Adam Eisenberg, who recently did the podcast with Richard Gage, which you can watch on Richard Gage's website, RichardGage911.org, or just go to the podcast and scroll until you get to Adam Eisenberg. Adam was doing body and body part recovery and remains recovery for 20 days from the afternoon of 9/11 through September 30th of 2001, and he was in the Navy area which included, when you look at the diagram or the graphic from the Pentagon Building Performance Report, where they have the little multicolored bubbles that where they claim they found either Pentagon worker bodies or alleged passenger bodies, a number about, I would say about a quarter to a third of them are in the area where he was for 20 days, and he saw no evidence of any passenger body or body remains, which would have been with seats, and they would have been strapped to seats. He saw nothing, and he also said, importantly, that the area where the Pentagon Building Performance Report alleged body and body part remains recoveries were found, the vast majority they claim in that graphic, which is in my PowerPoint presentation from the Pentagon conference on March 19th, the vast majority, two-thirds to three-quarters of those bubbles of alleged passenger bodies or body remains are actually in Wedge 2 in the Defense Intelligence Agency, and allegedly about 30 of them in the AE ring, if you can imagine, just outside the alleged exit hole. And it's exactly that Defense Intelligence area, DIA area, in Wedge 2, the furthest in of the alleged plane penetration path, by the official story, that Adam Eisenberg said that he and his Army body recovery teams were not allowed to go in. They were special teams in there, obviously, cover-up teams as far as I'm concerned. So I just wanted to make that, that's still not my question, yeah, which I'll wait until after others.
Yeah. Is there anyone else who would like to ask a question? I just want to make sure everybody's, I believe everybody's unmuted. Yeah, except Peter Ketchum, but I think, Peter, you must have muted yourself because I can't unmute you. I'm hoping that that's the case because I click on this normally and it, if it's our mute, then it, we can undo it. So anyway, everybody else seems to be able to speak, I think. Can I just confirm that? Did somebody say something? So I just know.
Yeah,
Craig, can you all? Okay, good. So I can hear you. So it, are there any questions or if not, we'll just, go to Barb's next question.
Craig, this is Peter Ketchum. Can you hear me?
Yes. I can now, yes. Yes.
Oh, okay. I generally always mute myself, you know.
Sure.
Right in the pilot dishes while I listen. So it's
yeah, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure we weren't muting you against your will or anything.
And I'm going to go back on mute now.
Okay, great. Thanks, Peter. Yeah, so I not having heard any requests for a question, I guess we'll go to Barb for the next one.
Yeah, this is Xander and I spoke after the conference, and one of the big, if I recall correctly, Xander, correct me if I'm wrong again, I believe that you said that part of your analysis, first I'm going to state it, and then I'm going to ask my question, and you can answer both together. I believe when we talked after the conference that you said part of your analysis results or findings was that based upon certain assumptions that it appears that if that object was a real plane, which I agree with you, I think it was, or a real vehicle of some kind, whether it was an air vehicle or not, because it was a ground vehicle. But anyway, if it's a real vehicle of some kind, that it was not traveling anywhere close to 560 miles an hour. And I just would like to hear if you can confirm that, if I got that right, and what analysis that finding is based on. And my comment is, I want to remind people, if you go to Richard Gage's website, richardgage911.org, and you click on the conference, if you haven't, the March 19th conference, Pentagon conference, if you haven't already watched it, or even if you have, if you've already paid your at least a dollar donation, you can click on that and put in your I guess, password or whatever it was. I believe you had to make up your own password with the Eventy website. and you'll be able to go in and watch the recordings of all of the presentation. So if you go back to the Coffey Chandler presentation, you will, close to the beginning, it blew my mind. I believe it was Coffey. It was one of them. I believe it was Coffey actually said, kind of under his voice, that their most current analysis is that the plane, which they, of course, assume was not only a 757, but Flight 77 indeed, because they rely upon the official radar and SDR data, that the plane was going at only, I believe he said something like 132 miles an hour. Okay, so that can't be, you can't have it both ways. You can't rely upon the FDR data and the official radar data and also have the plane going at only 130 miles an hour and be 100% in the ground floor.
Yeah, so to comment, I cannot make any claims whatsoever on the speed of this vehicle. I will say I don't think it's any sort of ground vehicle. When I use the word vehicle, I mean missile, drone, smaller aircraft, you know, some sort of airborne thing in flight. But the speed, you know, the camera was taking pictures at roughly one frame per second, and the distance between the wall of the building and the outer field of view is sufficient that, you know, we would only potentially capture one image at any point in that space. At that frame rate. And curiously, if it was truly traveling at 540 miles an hour, they could have from day one said, too bad, so sad, we never captured it because it was just outside of the field of view when the camera took one picture, and then it was in the building when the camera took the next picture, and there was room for the object to for an actual aircraft at 540 to traverse that whole space and not be captured on film at all by the security camera footage. So the fact that they did release something there, you know, it is what it is now. It's as part of our official record. We have to determine what, in fact, that thing is.
Approximately how many feet is it from the wall out to the furthest field of view, 75 degrees out? Approximately how much distance?
400 feet or so. And at,
okay.
And it, at 540 miles an hour, that's roughly 770 feet per second. You know, so there's
exactly.
A pretty big margin where it could have been totally outside of that.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So my final comment is, in my presentation at the Pentagon conference, there was one slide where I had yellow highlighted it because I hadn't been able to find the slide of my own analysis, similar to yours, in time. But I will send it. When I find it, which it's in my computer somewhere. I just can't remember what I called it when I saved it. But my analysis was this. It was very simple, much simpler than yours, actually. But it does have an assumption. And the assumption is that the important frames are frame for both cameras, outside security cameras, are frames 23 and 24. Frame 23 is the one that allegedly has some kind of an air vehicle in it. Frame 24 is the first big fireball, okay? If you assume, and I do assume for this analysis, but it's a simple analysis, like a kindergarten analysis or logic 101. If you assume, because frame 24 is a huge fireball and it's very red-orange, it hasn't turned black yet. So that implies, if you compare it with the moment of impact at the World Trade Center tower, especially Tower 2, it appears to be the moment of impact. If you assume it is within split seconds of the moment of impact, then by definition, at approximately one frame per second or approximately 750 feet travel per second, any plane would have to be way outside of the view of the camera, which only goes out to about 400 feet. It would have to be another 350 feet out your field of view in order to have captured it. In other words, this is an argument that anything in either of the frame 23s of both outside cameras aren't real.
I understand what you're saying. I think I would have to look closely at the rate of expansion of a fireball.
Of a fireball, yeah. And I recommend you do that by looking at World Trade Center 2 in fact. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I get what you're saying. That's a worthy approach to research for sure.
And I've done that. So I've done a red circle. I had a mathematician do the calculation, so I wouldn't be the only one doing it. When I find the graphic, the red circle goes out about 750 feet, and anything within that red circle to the wall should not have been in frame 26 on either camera, but it was. Okay.
If the fireball is sustained in that kind of reddish phase and the explosionary expansion phase for, you know, as long as a second or somewhere in there, then I think it could work, Barb. But, you know, we would have to really look at how long it's been.
No, exactly. As I said, it is an assumption that frame 24 captures essentially the moment of the impact, or alleged.
Yeah, no, great.
The moment
great
of the fireball. The first moment of the fireball, put it that way.
Yeah. This is how we will resolve this, is to keep applying those logical questions to the
scenario
and just using out, and whatever's left is going to be the truth. The things that don't work, we have to exclude, and from
That's
there
right.
we'll get our answers. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thanks, Barb. I would add a comment, Zandra. I think it, and I think we probably chatted about this briefly too, but I think it's tempting to sort of talk about, well, because the image in the cameras is so flawed, and given the fact that they could have just with speed, they could have just had nothing showing and claimed that it was a good reason for that. I would caution against concluding from that must be something real that was captured by the camera. In other words, just assuming that they would, you know, they would not have something sloppy to stand as their evidence. I think that's not necessarily the right thing to conclude. I think because we don't always know. We're not in their heads, so we don't exactly know what exactly they were trying to achieve. Or they may very well have not cared whether there were, you know, three people talking about this 20 years
right.
later, you know,
and
they might have just said, look, they're going to show clips of this on TV. People are going to buy it. That's enough. And I've heard people commonly say, well, in fact, David Chandler says this, you know, why would they fake a plane crash when it's so much easier to just actually crash a plane into the building? And to me, there's so many assumptions. Right. Well, there's so many assumptions of that. First of all, the biggest assumption is, why do we assume that they want to do what's easiest? I mean, what would be easiest would be not to do any of this at all. That would have been easier. But they chose to do it because they had an objective in mind, and so the idea, you know, my feeling about that question, I'm introducing something and then answering my own thing, but you know, the reason that you wouldn't want a real plane crashing into the building, assuming it's not actually Flight 77 with all those passengers in their seats, is because you wouldn't know that the plane would go into the building the way you know, Chandler and Costi claim it did. You wouldn't know that it would entirely go in. It might end up half broken or half open on the lawn with nobody inside. So you couldn't possibly take that chance. And I don't think they wanted to have, you know, dead bodies out on the Pentagon lawn anyway. So in other words, the assumption.
There weren't any dead bodies on the Pentagon lawn that we know of.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. Right, but they would not have wanted the contents of the plane to be visible to people walking on the sidewalk, I don't believe. So the idea that, you know, why wouldn't they just fly a plane in there makes an assumption that, you know, that we have exactly figured out, you know, what was in their heads and what their purpose of their operation was. And I don't think we should assume that. That's just the point I always...
That also assumes Chandler and Coste always assume, their paradigm is to assume the truth of the official story.
you know, yeah. that also assumes you can get a 757 into the first floor of the Pentagon. You can't.
Well, no. The idea that, I mean, the idea that you're the wings and the tail section, which they really did a good job of ignoring the, you know, the tail section, I think, the idea that, that none of those would end up broken off outside the building is ridiculous, in my opinion. It's just absurd.
Or in behind the smoke curtain in my presentation at the Pentagon conference, or if it was Flight 77, the wing tanks would have been completely full, and they would have allegedly hit five light bulbs, so that's two times for one wing and three times for the other, without exploding. And we've got Ralph Kolstad, who flew that very physical plane. On record, I give his quotes, his published quotes, in my presentation at the Pentagon conference, that even a single wing to the full wing tank hitting a single pole would have burst into a fireball before it could even have gotten to the wall. That did not happen.
Well, yes, and the funny thing you should mention that, Barbara, is that Chandler claims that the reason it makes sense that the wing could knock the pole over without the wing being damaged is because the wing was full of fuel and therefore it had a lot more, you know, weight to it, which seems ridiculous to me.
I don't believe that was his argument. If I recall,
It was his argument in 2015 at the Oakland 9/11 Film Festival.
Yes. And I don't believe it was on the 19th of this month. I believe what he said is that the leading edge of the wing is this really, I forget what he called it, but there's a very strong strut that goes out to the edge. And that was his new argument.
Adam picked up on, too, during the conference, which is really interesting and I think correct, was Kreisky and Chandler want folks to believe that when the plane impacted a large tree at the wall of the building, that it basically pushed and moved this tree, like 100 feet or something northward because of the kinetic energy it had. But at the same time, they want us to believe that when it hit these lighter light poles, those just simply fell over where they were. You know, that those weren't pushed in the distance. I mean, it's absurd.
Yeah, completely illogical and inconsistent.
Absurd. Totally inconsistent. Yeah.
Again, they twist themselves into logical pretzels in order to try to always fit the square peg of the official story into the round hole of the fact.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. But this light pole flight path, they dug themselves a hole. The camera footage, whatever it is, has dug the hole even deeper, and the story is just unraveled. So, I'll throw one other thing out there, because Barb, you mentioned that the number of remains that were alleged to have been found in the 80s drive.
Can you speak up? It's hard to hear you.
Yeah, sorry. I'm going to speak up, and I'm going to use the speaker just for this. The number of bodies that were alleged to have been found in the AE drive, I found an image of the firefighter suppressing efforts with water everywhere in the AE drive, deep water all over that building wreckage. And, talk about contaminating a sample. I don't see how it would be possible to resolve any biological material with all of that water, you know, let alone...
That did happen a bit later. The very first image is it's dry outside with not very much debris.
The very first, I double-checked, because there are pictures with water where the paint is not yet on the wall. And, in fact, some of that piping and other cladding stuff is not bent outward.
Yes, that's correct. But the very earliest photographs of the smoking hole do not yet have the water. But then there is water, and then they put the spray paint on the wall.
Yeah, later after it's dried, so really much later. So they had a lot of time to work with that scene by the time those other images came out. So, yeah, that was interesting. And then for those that are still here listening, the other curious finding in looking at all of this was that Wedge 1 had the large telecommunications trunk line to the building underneath it.
Could you repeat that? Could you hear it?
Yes, Wedge 1 had the large telecommunications trunk line to the building directly underneath it. So all of the data to the building on a cable, so I imagine that's the CIPRNet and everything else, all went under Wedge 1. And therefore, anybody conducting renovations or whatnot to that aspect of the building could have access to all of our military data. It's really frightening,
yeah.
Actually, to think about.
Couldn't hear any of that, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I'm about talked out, guys, so if we're good with questions, I'm going to pass the torch to Craig.
Sure. I'm not sure where that bad sound is coming from. Let me just sort of look at my computer. Anyway, yes, I will say thank you very much, Xander, for that presentation and for answering those questions. We really appreciate it, and I certainly appreciated you doing that at the conference. We're actually the second item on the agenda is kind of very much related. So maybe you'll want to stick around and you know, ask something yourself or whatever. We'll see. But, I want to say at this point, I neglected, which I seem to do every time I get this sort of rare opportunity to host the call because Cheryl can't make it. I seem to have this, amazing ability to forget that I was supposed to have the agenda approved at the beginning. And of course, so it's almost a moot point at this point, but there was one thing that I did want to mention because I had put as a second item that I wanted to make some comments about the conference. And then Barb expressed some interest in making some comments also. So as long as no one objects, then I would just amend the next item to basically include comments from both me and from Barbara and Xander, if he wishes to
make any
other broader. Yeah. Anybody, I mean, everybody will get a chance to talk, but I just wanted to make sure that was, that there were no objections to that, which I'm sure there wouldn't be. So are there any objections to sort of that little tweak of the second agenda item? Okay. I didn't think there would be. So very good. So I just wanted to make a few comments. I'm not sure this may be quite short, but I did want to make a couple of points for one thing, the conference had, and I'm interested in Barbara's perspective on this, it had some, shall we say, constraints. Some constraints were placed on the presenters. Yes, I know. I'm deliberately understating, and which I will compensate for now. Yes, there were constraints put on, and the degree of the constraints were not known to me until 2 weeks before the conference. So my whole approach to how I was going to say what I was going to say, I wouldn't say it had to be rethought because it's certainly in terms of the evidence. I mean, the evidence is the evidence, but in terms of my critique of other presenters and specifically Chandler and Costi, suddenly we were, it's not that we weren't allowed to disagree with them, but we almost, we couldn't say anything disparaging. To use Richard's term, we could not cast aspersions. Hold on, I better plug my phone in just in case. Don't want to lose you. So almost to the point of, I recall in one message being told, if you must point out inaccuracies, then you must do it in a neutral and sort of positive and respectful way. So even mentioning inaccuracies was getting into dicey territory. And my contention is that it all sounds very well and good to just say, well, let's keep the personal stuff out of it. Let's just look at the evidence, look at it scientifically. That's fine, but if you're dealing with people who may not be, how shall I put this, altogether honest in how they're presenting the evidence, this is really putting handcuffs on you and stopping you from really saying what is true. And I felt like I really was constrained in a very serious way from saying what I thought I needed to say about Chandler and Costi and what they were doing. And the irony of this was that once they got into their presentation, and I had, you know, there were a couple of times when I got a couple of shots in there, I'll admit. But when it got to them, they had no trouble. They basically slandered the CIT folks, calling them unethical and whatever. And Richard said nothing about that. And I thought to myself, wow, if I'd known unethical, we were allowed to use unethical. I would have happily called David Chandler and Wayne Costi unethical, which they are. But I didn't, because I thought that was against the rules. And I was actually so upset. I was so upset with what they were getting away with that I actually called in and spoke to Richard's wife and said, like, can you get a message to him? Because this is really making me furious.
It was a double standard by Richard.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the thing that didn't please me that much was when I asked a question and I pointed out two things that they said that were false. And I said, will you retract these false statements? And Richard kind of scolded me by name. I was the only person who got called out by name for not being, you know, polite and respectful. But to me, that was a straightforward question.
Chandler and Costi in their Q's and A's said, Barbara, when are you going to retract your statement? Which...
So there, see? There you go. There you go. They did a number of things. Chandler, when he was asked if he'd seen your presentation, he said, oh, well, I nodded off a few times. Which
that is the most disrespectful
thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they also praised Xander in a way to kind of also take a backhanded shot at Adam and I. Like, too bad your other team members couldn't be as nice and scientific as you are. So there was that. But I have a problem with this idea. And I think there are going to be more of these conferences. In fact, the next one's going to be about Shanksville. And I'm very, very concerned that members of Chandler's cabal are going to make their presence known at that one as well and try to do what Chandler and Costi did this time.
Yeah, that presentation. Yeah.
Oh, is he? Beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm being sarcastic when I say beautiful. Like, oh, brother. Yeah, of course, you know, and we know what that's going to be. We know what point of view that's going to be. It's just like it just happens that most of the official stories write about that too. Now, before I'm getting ready to bring you in here, Barbara, but I did want to say there were I detected a minimum of four statements, and there could have been many more, but four that stuck in my mind that were flat out falsehoods told by that team. And when I say falsehoods, I mean things that are false that they know are false. So I don't know what other word one could use for that. But, you know, I don't want to be mean, so I'll just say falsehoods. Two of the falsehoods had to do with Lloyd England, and one of them was just an absolutely incredible, like, invention that when England said, no, I wasn't there, I wasn't in that spot, I was more north, that he actually meant, like, 40 feet away. You know, right beside poll number two. This is absurd. I mean, this is not just absurd. This is a lie, is what this is. This is a dishonest spin on the evidence for devious purposes. That's there's no other way to put it.
You did call him out on that.
I did. Yes. I believe I actually snuck the word despicable in there one time and got away with that. So, one for me. But it was also the time when Wayne Costi claimed that he'd been fired from Architects and Engineers because he wanted to go out and research the Pentagon, which was an absolute other flat out lie. Because I know
the
whole story.
What was the reason?
Well, he apparently was in the process of forming Truth Action Project while he was on the board at AE, and he was even having the website basically copying the AE website very closely, and it was supposed to be like a redesign. I hope I got these facts right, but that they were going to be redesigning the AE website. Anyway, he was basically trying to duplicate it or come very, very close to the AE website with his new Truth Action project.
Well, I happen
so
to
they fired him.
I know a lot of the details of that. He did what the A&E board actually removed him for officially, I don't know. But right from the beginning, he was in fact trying to get A&E to broaden to cover the Pentagon at the same time that he had hired Tim Michael, who had been the original webmaster for the beautiful blue and orange A&E website that I liked a lot better than any sin. Tim Michael's signature color combination is the blue and the orange, the kind of navy blue and the orange. And so when he hired Tim Michael just used the blue and the orange. And Richard Gage and his A&E board objected to that, and they refused to change it. So he was out. And what they did when they first did the Truth Outreach website, the very first thing that they put up there was behind the smoke curtain, of all things, my Pentagon documentary.
Right,
so they
really,
in fact, were creating a website, at least at the beginning, and populating it with information about the Pentagon.
But he wasn't fired because he wanted to research the Pentagon. That's what I was making. That's not correct.
I don't know what their official reason was, but he was doing that at that time.
Yeah. Right. Yes, I mean there is a lot of detail to this. But I sort of called him out on that too, and you could see he was not pleased because I said there's more to that, more to the story than that, isn't there, Wayne? And he didn't like that at all. It's difficult when somebody makes a blatantly false comment like that Lloyd England one. I don't care so much about the Costi one, but the Lloyd England one. When you have to treat that as if, well, my respected fellow researcher, you know, I think is incorrect when he says blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, that doesn't cover it. In fact, what he was saying was something not only false, but something based on previous statements, something he knew to be false. And in the CIT video where they interview Lloyd England, it's absolutely clear. He points right on a photograph to the large base of pole number one, which the reason that's important is because it's physically impossible for pole number one both to have gotten through the fuselage of the plane in order to hit the cab. It's also impossible for it to have done the damage or the lack of damage that it was seen to the end of the inside of the taxi. So what they've done is they've invented this idea that it's the top part of pole number two. And now they're trying to say that Lloyd is saying that. Like, this is absolutely despicable and dishonest.
I know. You know, what Richard Gage, can I make a comment about your comment?
Yeah, oh, please do. Please do, yes.
Yeah. Okay. I understand the catch-22 or the difficult position Richard was in once this all started happening during the conference itself. Basically, the strictures or limitations that Richard put on in advance was he basically wanted us to act like senators in the U.S. Congress. When you wanted to take somebody by the neck and kill them, you were supposed to refer to them as my esteemed colleague. Okay.
Right.
And that's what Richard wanted, and I understood that. So you may remember I did that. In my presentation, the way I got by, actually exposing Chandler and Coste's absurdities was to repeatedly refer, when I went from slide to slide, to this is the claim of the official story and the advocates of Theory D. Okay?
Yes, how is that? Yeah.
So I removed the personalities from it, which is what Richard wanted us to do. That's extremely difficult when you know that someone is consciously devious, okay? But that was the rule. The problem in my mind it's okay for Richard, it was his show, to set the rules, but he didn't apply and enforce them equally.
Right. Yes, I would certainly agree with that. Yeah, I would agree with that, and I would point out. See, the problem. I was probably one of the latest ones, if not the latest one, to accept. Terry Messam probably was the last one, but I was probably the one before to accept the invitation. But I was certainly on board for 2 months anyway, and for me to be, I talked to Richard about the rules and. You know, he didn't want ad hominem attacks, and I said, okay, fine. I promised I would not call them a cabal, even though I argued that that's not an ad hominem attack, that I could actually back that up. But I said, okay, fair enough. I will not refer to them as a cabal. I was going to stick within those rules. But then when 2 weeks before, when I found out that I couldn't even – he wanted neutral – like a neutral tone or a positive tone, not even a critical, not even like a strong, even strong criticism was off the table. And to only find out 2 weeks before, I didn't like that. And as you point out, Barb, he was inconsistent. I mean, he let them get away with murder. And you know what really told me a lot about Mr. Chandler and how respectful he decided he wanted to be? Is during Richard's closing remarks of the whole thing at the end of the 2 hour Q&A, I was at this point, I was ready to fall asleep because it was like almost 1:30 in the morning. And I was just, normally I'm a night owl, but I think all the stress of the whole event, I wanted to go to bed. But as Richard's making his concluding remarks, David Chandler is fussing around his office, closing drawers and plopping things down. I thought, you can't wait like 3 minutes and let Richard close out the conference. Like, it just seemed like he didn't give a crap, didn't give a crap that Richard was giving his closing remarks. Anyway, Barb, do you want to?
I have another comment, and I think that'll be.
Yeah, go ahead.
For this topic anyway. I'm not sure you're aware of this, but I think people should be aware of it, if anyone is still on the call. But at least it's being recorded for prosperity and posterity. People should be aware that Adam Eisenberg was originally going to be one of the so-called special segment speakers for 15 minutes.
Yes.
And he is the guy that, his Army team was there for 20 days from September 11th to September 30th doing body recovery and human remains recovery and special sensitive document recovery inside the wedge one of the alleged plane penetration path. Didn't see any parts of the plane, didn't see any passenger bodies strapped to seats or luggage or anything that would give him reason to believe it was a passenger from a plane, etc. Didn't smell any jet fuel, etc. Okay, so Adam Eisenberg was slated and originally advertised by Richard, along with Kim Jenkins, that Adam Eisenberg was going to be on the one hand of the scale of balance, saying that, no, this is evidence that a plane didn't penetrate the building, and then Ken Jenkins was going to do a little video that he claimed that he was putting together of presumably taking clips from the internet and doing a collage of individuals or photographs of bodies, body parts, and people saying that they found some passenger bodies or pieces of passengers inside the building. Okay, well, Adam made it clear in an email thread with Richard, which Adam has shared with me. I know exactly what Richard said back. And Adam made it clear that he needed to expose Chandler and Coste as individuals. And Richard would not allow him to do it and said in words, in an email to him, if you do that, you will be closed down live.
Hmm.
And that upset Adam so much, that censorship, that he pulled out. And when he pulled out, Richard at least did the reasonable thing
the honest thing and told Ken Jenkins that he couldn't be in either, and he wasn't.
But yeah, but I must say that that's because I told him he had to do that. I mean, I had to do that, but I said you absolutely cannot have Jenkins in there then, because
Richard had already told me that he wouldn't allow Jenkins if Adam pulled out. Yeah.
Well, okay. Okay. And in any case, I
know you want to take credit for that, but I think very early on, because I was in a three-way phone call, Adam, Richard, and myself, when that happened, and Richard said, well, if you pull out, I'm going to have to pull Jenkins out.
That surprises me, because what Richard said to me was when he told Adam and I just the week of the conference, or no, I guess it was probably a week ahead, about what had happened with Adam, and he offered me the opportunity to use the 15 minutes to talk about, you know, witnesses to plane parts, I think it was.
Yes, that's correct.
And he didn't say anything about Jenkins. He was going to ask me if I wanted to use the extra 15 minutes to balance Jenkins. So he was.
That is correct.
At that point,
that is correct. That was his way of trying to keep Jenkins in. But when you said no, then he dropped Jenkins.
Because I told him to.
Yeah, but
I think
the earlier conversation with me, we agreed that Richard said, Richard told me before he even called you that he was going to call you and ask you to do that. But if you said no, he would have to drop Jenkins.
Well, good. In that case, I'm glad we were all on the same wavelength, because I actually said also that night that it bothers me that when we have somebody who was actually at the Pentagon firsthand, that we have to balance him with Ken Jenkins. Like, to me, that's ridiculous. And the whole idea of balance, I mean, this is like the way the mainstream media, you know, what they do with balance. Oh, we got a Democrat and a Republican. So we've got the whole panorama of views in the world, because we've got these two.
In addition to that, it's just adding another member of the same cabal. So there would be Chandler, Costi, and Jenkins, who really was the the very first people were Jim Hoffman and Ken Jenkins, who started the cabal.
Well, Hoffman was certainly around in the early days, wasn't he?
His Pentagon analysis is very clear, and it's basically the position that they all take, which is actually Chandler and Costi go further than Hoffman. But years ago, I think it was 2005 or 6 at the latest, and it's still online. Hoffman's analysis was that it was the A-757 at the Pentagon, but you couldn't definitively, with the evidence we have, because of withheld videos, etc., say that it was actually Flight 77. But of course,
Flight 77, right?
Because Chandler and Costi rely upon the FDR, alleged FDR, which I've shown couldn't have been from Flight 77, according to American Airlines' own press release, right?
Right.
They rely upon the alleged FDR data, allegedly found inside the Pentagon, and they rely upon the official radar data, which I've also rebutted. So because they rely upon both the official story FDR data and radar data, they are saying more than just the 757 hit at exactly when and where the official story says. They are saying that Flight 77 did.
Right.
Am I muted, or is everyone, can I talk?
Oh, yeah, would you like to? Yes, absolutely.
Hi. I believe what Barbara Heineken told us, the hope for planes were still in existence after 9/11. But I want to talk about me, because I was told the summer of 9/11, I was in Ocean Grove, New Jersey with a friend, and my story of 9/11 begins way back with Ralph Nader, and the media wanted to create wars way before 9/11. And they even put that in the newspapers, war is inevitable before Desert Storm. So, and I document that. So anyhow, I was told the summer of 9/11, two planes swept in front of us. My friend Eva, one was about Pearl Harbor to come, another about a war against black community. And because of political crimes, I reported that. And I think my story goes way back to the Kennedy assassinations, because that's also related to me, Tishman, and that's also related to me. But anyhow, I want to talk about today, because the Pentagon budget related to these created wars was increased in Christmas, and now it's bigger than the military of 11 nations. And I am talking because of crime towards me, and the morning of 9/11 was the third time I was warned about 9/11 to come in reporting landlord crimes. My landlord is connected with the person who became mayor in 9/11, and that is going on today. And this apartment above me has machinery in his apartment, and I'm told my landlord is criminal, and I'm not going to move, but I'm a little bit, I don't know how to confront this. I am doing this all the time. I'm confronting this all the time. There was a KKK guard hung outside my window, all kinds of stuff. So, so that's kind of what I wanted to say. I don't know how what I'm going to do tonight. This guy on machinery, and he does all kinds of noise harassment. My landlord is connected with a person who became mayor on 7. He's become mayor. We spoke one of 9/11 times. And the budget was increased yesterday. Code Pink said it to be larger than 11 nations combined. So we're going to have a war, just like the 7 wars created from 9/11. And I don't know what to do about this. I'm just one person. So thank you for letting me share. It's best for my life to be able to share.
Can you please tell us who you are? Did you say Tishman?
Yeah, Fern Tishman. You know me, Barbara.
I do?
Yeah, I've been to a lot of things with Kevin Barrett, and yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Did you have a question for the presenter, Craig?
Yeah. Sorry, I actually my call dropped there, so I just had to call back in. So I missed the last 30 seconds or so. What did you say, Xander?
Oh, I was wondering if the speaker right now had a question for you, because I thought you were still presenting.
Yeah. I think I've let this maybe become a little more informal, I guess. But yes, is there anybody like to ask anything about the conference particularly, or any of the stuff that Barbara and I have referred to with respect to that?
I would like for anybody still on the call, just remember, if you did donate at least $1 for the conference on March 19th, Richard Gage's Pentagon Conference, you are able to go back to his website, richardgage911.org, and click on the conference box in the upper right-hand menu. And then you just put in your password that you did, and you get to the events page. And the first page that comes up, you scroll down a little bit to the schedule, the speaker schedule on the event page, and in perpetuity, ad infinitum,
if you click on I Was Theory A, if you click on the schedule for Barbara Honegger Theory A, you click on that, a little drop-down menu comes down, and at the top, you're going to have a you can click on my PowerPoint slide. You can click, and when you when that menu comes down, then also there is the, you can click on something that takes you to the archived video of my entire presentation, and then below that there's also a little bio, and below that there are all the links that I, as a presenter or speaker, want you to be able to go to and watch or read. And the same thing is true for Craig, the same thing is true for Coste and Chandler, and the same on the schedule, the event T schedule page, and the same thing is true for Terry Misson. So all of those things are there for you. And if you didn't watch the conference live and haven't donated, you can do that at any time by going to Richard Gage's website, richardgage911.org, click in the upper right-hand box for the 9/11 Con conference, and donate at least a dollar, and you will get the information to get to the eventee page. You make up a password, you go in, and you can do this also ad infinitum into the future for only a dollar or more donation.
Well, that's excellent. That actually fits as a comment for this item, and also a nice little announcement also, Barbara. Covered both. Let me ask if anybody has any more questions or comments about this topic, and if so, we'll do them. If not, then I will take us into announcements, and I do have one myself. So, would anybody else like to make a comment about the conference, and ask either me or Barbara, or if you want to ask Andrew a question, then that's fine too.
I have a comment. Yeah. Strike here. Yeah, it's sort of indirectly about the conference. You talk about a cabal.
Yes.
I think there's this guy from England who's been a pretty straight shooter, Ian Henschel. He just put out a newly revised edition, and in there he's sort of hinting at the fact that the official story may in fact be true in there. That's what he's hinting at. So they may have gotten to him. I don't know. I think it might be something to look into to see why he's sort of wavering on that.
Yeah, I've got a comment on that. I've interacted with Ian Henschel for a long time about that. This is not new for him, actually. I guess it took him a while to do his updated edition of his book. But the bottom line with Ian is that, and this is also the bottom line with anybody who supports the official story to date, and that is that you have to support the official story, in particular at the Pentagon, in order to reach the deep pockets of the Saudis in the big case against Saudi government. And because both of the alleged Pentagon plane hijackers, Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar, those are the only two out of the all 19 alleged hijackers that are in the 28 pages and are also the core of the huge Motley Rice and James Kringler lawsuit against the Saudi government. So if you want to have some modicum of justice for the next layer in of the Muslim Patsy Onion, who are actually just co-conspirators, Bandar Bush with the Bush crime family, right, and Cheney and company,
right,
the real inside perpetrators, then you have to push the official. You have to push the official story, in particular at the Pentagon, and that's what they are doing.
Okay.
Interesting. Glad to have you. Glad to have you with us, Frank. Glad to have you back.
Yeah. Can you hear your voice, Frank?
Yeah, man. Yeah. Hey, just a light comment. The conference was designed to have a consensus. And, at the end of the day, we had three teams that basically coalesced around one common theme. So it will be interesting to see if there's any follow-through with the consensus panel to accurately report that consensus.
It's not a chance of that.
Yeah, but if by consensus panel you mean the David Ray Griffin, Elizabeth Woodworth, the answer is no. They basically closed that down with their book.
Have they? They're not doing more points?
No. That's what Elizabeth told me in an email just before the conference.
Right. Well, the consensus panel, in my opinion, as a whole, that's an interesting discussion topic. We should perhaps do a discussion about that on a future call. I think it's, you know, deeply flawed, and particularly when you have, at least five or six, well, not at least, I think it's five or six members of the Chandler group who are members on the consensus panel, that they have a veto. Anything that's proposed that would contradict the 757 hitting the Pentagon on the official flight path, they can vote it down. They have enough. You only need four votes to veto something, and they have six.
Yeah.
So that's a built-in flaw.
They have to reach about 85%, I think, in order to have a point go public. But the other side of the coin is also true. And what Elizabeth Woodward told me, and I've got it in an email from her, in addition to phone calls, and over breakfast and lunch with Bonnie Faulkner at the Pentagon Denver conference that the Chandler Coste group and Ken Jenkins group put on, that I attended personally. I don't think you were able to do that, Craig, right? You weren't there?
No, I was not there, no.
Well, I was there. And so I had breakfast and lunch. We were in the same hotel. Bonnie Faulkner and I shared a room, and we had meals with Elizabeth Woodward. And she said, you know, basically there are only four Pentagon points in the, if you go to the 9/11consensuspanel.org, and in the left-hand vertical menu, scroll down a bit to the Pentagon section, and there are only four points after all those years that they reached their 85 or whatever it is consensus. And they're not critical points at all. And she told me they're important, you know, like foreknowledge by Rumsfeld and that kind of thing. And that Hani Hanjour couldn't have been controlling the plane at the final moment. And that's assuming it was Flight 77, at the Pentagon at all. But anyway, what she said in words to me is that there was no way that they were going to do anything else on the Pentagon because they could not reach consensus within the group.
Well, I would offer a comment on that, Barbara, because I also have I also interacted with Elizabeth when I created that No 757 Hit the Pentagon list that I put on my website. She admitted to me at that point that they had never even presented a point that dealt with the question of what caused the damage at the Pentagon. They had never even presented such a point to the members of the panel. So
that
it wasn't that they didn't reach consensus. It's that they didn't even allow them to consider the question. And I would argue, let me just finish this one point, Barbara. I would argue that that is because Elizabeth was absolutely opposed. She was opposed to the notion all the way along. She had no interest in what CIT had done. She didn't even I don't think admit to even having looked at any of their material. And so she was just never going to consider that no matter what. And it's unfortunate to me that David Ray Griffin, to me, what he did in his books was much more valuable than what that consensus panel did. All those points were already very well made in his books. And
yes,
unfortunately, the consensus panel just, to me, that just gave away the power of what he had already established.
Well,
I think that's unfortunate.
I have some more information on that, though. What Elizabeth told me is that they didn't present the point because she knew, or maybe David Ray Griffin as well, but she was speaking for herself, that she knew that there could not be consensus reached. So what was the point of bringing the point for discussion? But the other thing I'll go on record, and I have his email. David Ray Griffin emailed me and said, this was years ago, I would say it's at least, it's at least 6 or 7 years ago now. But the consensus panel was underway, And they had already focused, of course, on the World Trade Center. And they were then moving towards considering points on the Pentagon, of which they now have four only. Okay. And David Ray Griffin personally wrote me with a copy to Elizabeth. It was not from Elizabeth to me. It was from him to me. And he said, well, it's very rare that we, meaning the consensus panel, he and Elizabeth, he was referring to, it's very rare that we reach out to someone who is not one of the, I think it's, what is it, 23 members of the panel, to ask for your input. But because of your work, which David, highly respected of my work, has said so, because of your work on the Pentagon, we are asking you to propose Pentagon points and present your evidence. And I did that in spades. And I can only presume, though I don't know, that it was Elizabeth who decided not to move forward with any of those proposed points. But David Ray Griffin wanted them.
Well, I can guarantee that you're right that it was Elizabeth. I would say actually you and I met each other in person. The one time we met each other was in 2011, right at the Toronto hearings. You recall that?
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Yes, you very kindly got me into the room. As I recall.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, you only one. You only one.
I'm eternally grateful that you were prepared to take pity on me. It's a big topic, but I see that things that happened in 2011 had a harmful effect, in my opinion, on the truth movement. One of them was Richard's withdrawal of support of CIT. Another one was the Chandler and Cole hatchet piece, also against CIT and the Pentagon. And the other one was David Ray Griffin's consensus approach, which basically just conceded a big piece of the field to Chandler's gang. And I think we've been paying the price for those.
You mean by conceding the field? You mean by putting five or six of their members on the consensus panel?
Well, not just that. No, because a couple of those people weren't known to be, you know, Fran Schur and Dwayne Dietz were not known to be in their camp back then. So it wasn't, but no, I'm thinking more of, if you remember at the Toronto hearings, David Ray Griffin did a presentation, I think it was his second of two, where he just got up there and he it was all about his consensus approach at the Pentagon, basically saying, you know, Chandler says this and Legg says this and Chandler says this. And I know, like he gave them such a, kind of a level of, not credibility, because he was disagreeing with them, but he was basically saying, it doesn't matter whether, you know, a large plane or whether Flight 77 crashed into the building. It only matters whether Al-Qaeda was at the controls. And
yeah, which is not true. Which is not true.
No, it's not true. Because, first of all, that point, that position has really gained the movement nothing. Like, you know, it's not like we had this big breakthrough, the Honey Hunger, you know, breakthrough.
Yeah,
so
and by the
it
way,
it was a tremendous concession to them, I thought.
Well, David Ray Griffin published two books, one just before the 10th anniversary and one for the 10th anniversary, New Pearl Harbor Revisited and 9/11 10 years later. And in preparation for my Pentagon presentation just a couple of weeks ago now, time flies, I read them both again. And he actually has in one of the two books, I believe it's 9/11 10 years later, but one of those two books, there is a chapter that says 9/11 consensus approach. And he is his presentation, his second presentation at the Toronto hearings, which were for and on the 10th anniversary, where I also spoke. I was the only Pentagon speaker there at all. Except for what he did in his second presentation, which was basically to verbally present that chapter in his book where he basically says that the only thing the movement should focus on in order, because that's what we can concede or reach consensus on, is that Hani Hanjour couldn't have been at the controls in the final phase of the approach. Well, that's not good enough if there's evidence that it wasn't Flight 77 there at all.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It was dumbing down the evidence to avoid, as a way to seemingly skirt around the quote unquote controversy within the movement. And the problem is that approach assumes that it's a legitimate, honest controversy, an honest disagreement among honest people, and I don't think it ever was. I think his concession to them, to me, was disastrous, and it gave them a profile, and it gave them some momentum that they have used to screw up the movement for the last 10 years.
He legitimized the idea, which is, by the way, stated in words, if you can believe it. If you go to Kevin Ryan's book, Another 19, there's only one Pentagon chapter, I believe it's chapter 10, the first page, or maybe it's the second or third page. But anyway, I believe it's on the very first page of that chapter, only one chapter on the Pentagon. He states in words, this is almost verbatim, it is essential for the movement to assume as much of the official story as possible about the Pentagon. He wouldn't be caught dead, and none of this cabal would be caught dead saying that for the World Trade Center.
Right. Yes, that is a very stunning moment in that book. Yes. And he's kind of a peripheral member of that group too. Sorry.
Why concede this? Yeah, he's peripheral. He's never publicly said I'm part of this group, but he has affinity with them, with their assumption of as much of the official story as possible. Yeah.
Well,
Kevin Ryan was on board with the official story at the Pentagon way before that. In a Hartford conference, it was the 6th or 7th anniversary. I was driving him to the train, and he says, I can't talk about the Pentagon and, you know, what's going on there, because I had friends on the flight. He was already backing out back then.
Oh.
We're talking 15 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. You told me that in the car.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So from the get-go, was he a limited hangout? I don't know. I don't want to make accusations, but, you know, I'll give you the Building 7, but you're not going to get the Pentagon. I'm just wondering if that's what his role was.
Yeah, by the way, I want to go on record with something. This is really important because it triggered the memory of it with what you just said, Frank. And that is that, you know, I'm co-chairman of the board of the Lawyers Committee now, as well as, you know, one of the two investigators. And this is now my 6th year, okay? So I'm quite knowledgeable about everything that happens inside the Lawyers Committee. And
right.
I will tell you that not too long ago, it was some months ago, but it was definitely, it was like towards the latter part of last year, not that long ago, not even a year ago. Chandler contacted the Lawyers Committee and offered to negotiate, to make a deal that if the Lawyers Committee publicly came out, basically for their position at the Pentagon, that they, I call them the cabal because that's what they are, that they would publicly acknowledge the evidence of explosives, i.e. Honegger's work.
Right.
And it was Dave Meiswinkel who told us that in a board call, and I exploded. I'm telling you, I exploded. I said, you do not negotiate reality.
Right.
Holy jeez, yeah.
And it was dropped. I mean, the board said,
Barbara.
No way. No way, Jose. We don't make deals.
You negotiate everything except your principles.
Yeah, right.
Just think of what that's saying. It's saying that they were prepared to say publicly that they believe there were explosives used in the building, but because they didn't get a deal, they took the opposite position publicly, and they've done so ever since.
Right. In the Pentagon conference just passed on March 19th, you heard Coste say, say, you know, there were no explosives. It was a unitary event. It was just the plane impact and the fireball and any inside explosions from the fire. You know, there were absolutely no separate explosions. That's ridiculous when you look at my presentation. Ridiculous.
Well, he also said that there's no evidence at all of which is even worse in a way, because he's not just saying that that wasn't the result. He's saying
that's
there isn't even evidence that suggests that it could be the result.
Yes, and that's precisely what the insiders who did 9/11 went on TV while the two towers were still smoking before the first one came down, saying there were no explosives involved. I whenever Coste says something like that, I think of the morning of 9/11 itself. And I know they know better because they tried to cut a deal with the lawyers committee.
Wow.
Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that came out tonight on this call. Thank you, Barb.
And by the way,
so am I.
Richard Gage knows that. He was on the lawyers committee on the board call when that happened.
Oh, so it's that recent?
Yes.
Oh my God! Wow.
That was
okay.
Way back in October. That was.
Are we supposed to know this?
You know it. You can't unknow. So I'm furious. I'm furious with their conscious deception.
Wow. I you know, without specifically accusing an individual of, you know, being an agent, because that's generally, you know, considered to be a no-no, I consider this operation that they're all part of to be a COINTELPRO operation. I have no doubt about it and no hesitation saying it. And people say, well, you're saying that they're agents. I'm saying I'm not, because you can be honestly caught up in an operation. You can be think that it's legitimate and people are being honest and you join in and you want to be part of it. So it doesn't necessarily mean that any given person is an agent. It could be that somebody's been duped or somebody's just kind of gone along.
Witting agents and unwitting agents.
Right.
Yeah, but now we now know for certain that Chandler and Coste are not unwitting.
Can I?
Well, we know they're liars. We know they're liars.
No, I just told you. It was Chandler who proposed the deal to the lawyers committee, and it was Coste, who was his partner, including in the conference just passed on March 19th, knowing that the deal was offered and rejected by the lawyers committee, who then said on the conference just passed, Richard Gage's conference, on the Pentagon, he said there is, quote, no evidence, unquote, of explosives, but they were willing to negotiate that.
That's a stunning news, and I'm glad you shared it with us, Barbara, because that's important.
Yeah, okay.
So I know a hell of a lot more stuff like that, but so that is the one that I can prove to you. So what happened?
All right, guys, I gotta get off at this point, but it was an interesting evening. Let's have more of these discussions.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for being here, man. Appreciate the input at the end.
Thanks,
Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.
Are there any other questions or comments? If not, we'll move to announcements. But is there anything else anybody wants to say?
So what happened on planes that were killed? I remember after 9/11, the police came to the person I was working with because her friend was killed on one of the planes. So there were people that were killed on those planes. I have an idea.
There were people that the officials of the government claim were killed. I personally believe that the plane crashed, just as the Indianapolis FAA air traffic control reported to Air Force Search and Rescue. Okay? But that wasn't anywhere near the Pentagon, and it was after it had precipitously descended from 35 to 29,000 feet just before the transponder went off. They reported it likely crashed. If it had crashed, there would be dead bodies.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, unless anybody's, did I hear Xander's voice? Were you about to say something, Xander? Or?
No, I just thanked Frank for his participation at the end of the call.
Oh, right. Okay. Right. So,
I was trying to.
Sorry?
This is Peter Ketchum. I was trying to jump in.
Oh, yeah, okay. Thanks, Peter.
Okay, so I apologize to Barbara here. When I missed something. My mind must have wandered for a second. Can you just rephrase in a few sentences this there was something astounding about lawyers' committee and negotiation, and
yeah.
For some reason I blanked out or something, and this sounds really important. Can you just rephrase it for me?
Yeah, it's very important. Well, it might have been that it was so shocking that you couldn't process it the first time.
I had trouble processing it.
All
right. So here's the bottom line. My work on the Pentagon has been out there for a decade or more, publicly, behind the smoke curtain, 9/11 museum virtual walking tour, all of my public presentations, my presentation at the Toronto hearings, my Chapter 13 in the Toronto hearings report, my chapter in Jim Mars's New York Times number one best-selling book, the Terror Conspiracy and the Terror Conspiracy Revisited, my Pentagon attack papers published for back in, I think, 2005. I mean, for literally a decade and a half or more, I have been public on the evidence of pre-placed explosives at the Pentagon, paralleling our certainty of pre-placed explosives and incendiaries at the World Trade Center. Okay, now in addition to that, I'm also a hybrid. My position is hybrid. There was a plane destroyed at the Pentagon. It was smaller than the 757. It did not quite hit the wall. It was destroyed just before it would have around the heliport. So, plane, yes, not at the official story time, not at the official story place, smaller than a 757. But my main finding that I'm known for is proof of pre-placed explosives, at least starting almost 8 minutes before the official story alleged impact time of Flight 77. Okay, that's been out there for years. And these people have been attacking me that entire time. And in fact, Wayne Coste only came out of the woodwork, as he said at the conference just a few days ago, about 2 weeks ago, Richard Gage's conference. Wayne Coste mentioned that he only got into the Pentagon in 2015. Well, Behind the Smoke Curtain came out in 2014. And it was 2015 where it was supposed to have been featured at the 9/11 Film Festival that Ken Jenkins runs in Oakland, California. And Ken Jenkins was only, there was a vote of 11-1 to show Behind the Smoke Curtain that marshals the evidence for pre-placed explosives at the Pentagon, just like at the World Trade Center. And Ken Jenkins vetoed it. His one vote vetoed 11 votes. Okay, it was shown the next year, 2016. By then, Coste had come out of the woodwork to attack my work. Okay, so these people have been attacking the very idea that there were, that the Pentagon attack wasn't a unitary event, and in particular, that there couldn't have been explosives at the Pentagon, pre-placed explosives. Okay, so that's the context for what just recently happened. What recently happened is, it is Coste and Chandler who are now leading, and also Ken Jenkins. They're the top three people who are pushing the official story at the Pentagon, including in Richard Gage's conference 2 weeks ago. So go back in time to about last October. At one of our lawyers committee board meetings, these are on the phone, of course, with COVID, they were not in person, and we're all over the country. So at one of our every 2 week board meetings, this was before that, because it was shortly before September 11th, because it was Dave Meiswinkel, while he was still with the Lawyers Committee Board, he was no longer with the board as of the end of September. October 1st, he was no longer even with the Lawyers Committee. Okay, so it was in August or September, as we were in the lead up to the 20th anniversary. And on our board call, in the lead-up to the anniversary, Dave Meiswinkel mentioned that Chandler had contacted him and offered the Lawyers Committee a negotiated deal, that if on the 20th anniversary that the lawyers committee would take a stance, a public stance, in favor of their position on the Pentagon, that they would publicly acknowledge the evidence for pre-placed explosives at the Pentagon. In other words, my work that they had been attacking for a decade and a half.
Well, this, yeah, no, I listened very carefully this time so I could really absorb this. You know, and I guess I understood now why you were all then saying what you were saying. I mean, the first thing that pops into my mind now is none of this involves negotiation. I mean, this shouldn't be anything. This is not a negotiation. It's trying to find the truth. It's trying to investigate, not negotiate.
Right, which is exactly what I said on that call. The moment that came out of Dave Meiswinkle's mouth, I exploded. Because this was about my work and my facts and the actual, you know, compelling converging lines of evidence for pre-placed explosives, both at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And I said, you don't negotiate reality. And the board agreed. I mean, they were appalled.
Yeah, that you said it much better than I could have. You don't negotiate reality.
Well, they're trying.
Stunning.
You know,
that's stunning.
I have to admit that one thing I see is there are some in the 9/11 Truth Movement who I've seen done excellent work regarding the World Trade Center. But then when it comes to the Pentagon, and I admit the Pentagon is not really of interest. It's not my main interest, you know. So, but what I've seen is that, you know, they'll do excellent work regarding World Trade Center. And then it's like when they get involved with the Pentagon, it's like a trance or a hypnosis comes over them.
That's right.
Or Peter, it's that their credible work on the World Trade Center was a way of gaining them the credibility so that they could then sabotage the Pentagon evidence.
What on earth could be their motive?
Well, I proposed the motive. I proposed the motive in this call. I'm not sure if you were on at the beginning, Peter. I believe the motive, or part of the motive, the main part of the motive, is that if you don't accept the official story at the Pentagon that Al-Hazmi and Al-Bidar were two of the five alleged hijackers on the Pentagon plane, and that it was Flight 77 at the Pentagon, and that they did crash and die there, then the big case against Saudi Arabia by 10,000 9/11 victims' family members reaching into the deep multi-billion pockets of the Saudis fail.
Okay. Well, thanks for recapping that for me. I'm glad I asked because that was really important about that negotiation or attempt.
It's very, very, very important. It proves they're doing this consciously.
Well, it's the darndest thing. I'm just sort of bewildered by it all. But thank you for explaining it.
You're
Peter,
welcome.
Zander Arani here. I just want to comment. One of my notions on this is that, in addition to what Barb just said, it would be plausible to blame what happened in New York on an outside force. But you could, if any of what we're saying regarding American Airlines 77, et cetera, and down the road, Shanksville, is true, then of course that it further implicates internal forces and the compromise of our government.
Well, in particular, the Pentagon itself.
It connects
the Pentagon as part of the inside perpetrators to the World Trade Center. That's what they're afraid of.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
And it's interesting.
Hold the line on that issue.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, the one part of the official story they're prepared to deviate from, which is the notion, well, I mean, obviously they're not claiming that Hani Hanjour, although Chandler says that there were hijackers, and he claims now the hijackers were hijacked. So they are prepared to say it might have been remote control. The plane might have been taken over by remote control. But it's interesting that the one place where they're prepared to deviate from the official story is an area where you can't say with 100% certainty that remote control would have come from insiders, you know, as you said, internal forces. It could have been somebody else could have taken control, right?
Yeah.
So it's a way of letting the U.S. government and the military off the hook once again. I would add one thing that not only is it a good way of taking the Pentagon off the table, because really they've made a lot of people in the movement, you know, just kind of say, oh, I don't even want to talk about the Pentagon, it's too controversial. So they've taken it off the table for a lot of people. But it's also a good way of just tying up the movement for a decade, having to argue with these people. Instead of focusing as we should be and as everybody else is on, you know, proving the things that are false in the official story, proving that they're false, we have to argue with people supposedly among our own number that the official story is even false. You know, it just keeps us fighting internally, or what appears to be internally, instead of doing what, you know, and the example I would give is, you know, I could give a list of people, David Ray Griffin, Barbara, Richard Gage, you know, you name it, what percentage of their books, presentations, interviews, papers, whatever you want to list, what percentage of them would focus primarily on contradicting the official story? And the answer would be 100%.
Right.
And when you look at Chandler, Costi, Jenkins, Windham, and the rest of their crowd, and you look at all their papers and all their interviews and all their stuff they've done and their PowerPoint, what percentage of those focus primarily on challenging the official story at the Pentagon? And the answer is 0%.
Yeah.
So what does that tell you?
Well, what's interesting, what Peter Ketchum said, and it has been a conundrum, especially somebody like Chandler, who made his bona fides by getting NIST. He's the only person in the movement who's, to my knowledge, gotten an official government agency to admit it was wrong and admit to default at World Trade Center 7 for the first third. I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah, he didn't get them to do that. They chose to do it. Nothing can force. Richard says, you know, he forced NIST, and it's not true.
Well,
NIST wasn't forced to do anything.
I have something.
Well,
to add
allow me to say he's given the credit for that. Okay.
Indeed.
I'm agreeing with Peter Ketchum that it is a conundrum. People just they don't know how to process that somebody who could have made such a contribution, or at least been given credit for it by people like Richard Gage, and there's reasonable reason to give him credit for it, David Ray Griffin does, that he becomes like this little demigod in the movement.
Yes.
And so
yes,
if he takes the position on the Pentagon, you have to give it the benefit of the doubt. No, you don't.
No, you don't. That's right.
Barbara, in a very revealing interview that David Chandler gave with Julia Frasca on her Unthinkable channel, Chandler admitted...
I haven't seen that. I'd like to see that.
He was not the only one that was about to confront NIST on freefall acceleration. He happened to be the one moved into position to do so. He says that.
Who else was about to do that or did do that?
It might have been Stephen Jones. I'm not sure. But there were others that were essentially poised to ask the very question that he asked, and he happened to be the one to do it, and he admits as much.
Okay. Well, regardless, he's given the credit for this. It's because, in my opinion, it's because of that he is given credit for that, which is reasonable to give him some credit for it, that his position, and therefore the people in the cabal around him, are given the benefit of the doubt, even by people like David Ray Griffin, who knows better.
Yes. Yes, he does know better. You know, when I created a Facebook group to go along with the No 757 Hit the Pentagon thing, I did not admit David Chandler into the group, because I thought, you know, we're here, that's all we get is David Chandler all over the place. This is a group where the people who support this statement can discuss things. We don't need David Chandler in there. David Ray Griffin wrote to me and asked me if I would consider allowing David Chandler to join the group. So, yeah, which was stunning to me. It was stunning to me that it's like, you know, David Ray Griffin kind of running an errand for David Chandler. I couldn't quite believe that. Anyway,
that's right. And and Bill Jacoby tried to get Chandler onto the Lawyers Committee board, but thank goodness the vote was against that.
Well, I didn't know it was Jacoby's idea. That's interesting.
Yep. Well, he carried their water and admitted it.
Right. Well, listen. Is there anybody else that has a burning desire to say something? I wouldn't mind wrapping this up. And I did have one thing I'd really have to get in here, because it's something. It's a architects and engineers thing that's important. Well, it's something I really want to just quickly say. Is it okay with everybody if I just move to announcements and
then? Yeah, let's do it.
It has been a long call. It's been an interesting call. I've enjoyed it. And sometimes when you have more modest number of people, you can actually kind of, it can be quite enjoyable because it becomes more discussion and a little less formal. So that's not always a bad thing. Anyway, I want to say, so we'll move on to announcements, and I just want to make one quickly and say that it's about basically Andy Steele. For those, I don't know how many people have heard about this, but Andy Steele at Architects and Engineers has written a graphic novel that is a very impressive piece of work. It's almost 400 pages, and it's got a 9/11 theme to it, so it incorporates some actual 9/11 figures along with sort of some fictional characters, and it really sort of looks at sort of the, you know, some of the difficulties that people have in trying to open up other people's minds to difficult information like this. And I just wanted to say, in the words, there was a terrible long delay, which was not AE's fault at all, or not Andy's fault. It had to do with the shipping industry in the U.S. and they were backed up at the ports, and there were like shipping containers that were just kind of sitting on the docks for long periods of time, and so there was a pre-sale of this graphic novel, and unfortunately it was delayed, months actually, which was a real shame, because people I'm sure got impatient, but it really was not anything that AE could do anything about. All we could do is just keep trying to get them through, and so finally, anyway, they have arrived, and they're now available for sale at the AE 9/11 Truth store on the website.
Oh, cool.
So I would, and if you want to, if you're looking to buy one, I can let you know that, next week they're going to be on sale next week for a little, 4 or 5 days. So, you could always, if you want to buy one, maybe, wait a couple of days.
It's only going to be for sale for 4 to 5 days.
No, it's going to be on sale for 4 or 5 days. Like, in other words, it's going to be a discount. There'll be like a discount for a few days on the price.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
Right. No, it'll be on sale on an ongoing basis. But basically, it's a very, very compelling and serious but entertaining graphic novel on the subject. And so it's really quite a piece. I was one of the people who helped with the editing of it, but it's Andy's baby, and it got endorsements from people like, well, Rosie O'Donnell gave him a quote and an endorsement, and Graham McQueen did likewise, and a couple of family members, Drew DePalma and Michelle Little, both.
What's the title?
It's called Born on 9/11.
Okay.
And I can give you just a couple of sentences here, what the basic gist of it, what it's about. It's a story of 18-year-old Kevin Langdon, who was born just as his father, a New York City firefighter, dies in the North Tower of the World Trade Center. And as he turns 18, he begins to wake up to the evidence provided by AE 9/11 Truth and slowly starts to speak out about it. And this causes other forces to come into play to counter him. And it's quite interesting, and does feature some real folks like Bob McElvain, Roland Engel, Richard Gage, and Tony Zambodi. So
is the main character a real person? Probably not.
No, the main character is this fictional young person whose father, also fictional, you know, dies fighting as a firefighter. He dies in the building, and his son is just being born the same day. And so this is then the, you know, shoots into the future where the boy then becomes, you know, 18, and he starts to take a look at the evidence. So that's pretty cool. So I hope you'll all tell your friends about it and pick up a copy. It's definitely well worth it. So that's my announcement. Anything else?
Well, thanks everybody. This was valuable.
Yeah. Well, good. So if that's all we've got, then great. I appreciate everybody's presence on the call, and thank you, Xander and Barbara. And we'll see you. The next call is going to be. I'm even going to give you the date here. I think here. Okay, no, going the wrong way here. It'll be April 27th, Wednesday, April 27th.
So I would like to remind everybody again, if you would want to see them again, even if you saw it live, the Pentagon Conference on March 19th, or if you haven't seen it, all you have to do is go to richardgage911.org and click on the 9/11 con box in the upper right-hand corner. I believe that's where it still is. And if you've already donated at least $1, you'll be able to now get all of the PowerPoint from the speakers. If you go click on the right button and go to the eventy page and then click on each of the series in the conference schedule, and that will bring a pull-down menu, and you should be able to get the PowerPoint slides and the videos and the bios and all of the links to anything that any of the speakers want you to watch or read, you know, in perpetuity into the future. So if you want to go back and watch, you can do that. If you want to see the PowerPoint slides of all the speakers, you can do that. I know mine are up. So, you know, I don't know, Craig, if you guys had any slides, but Richard has asked for anybody.
Yeah, I haven't put them up yet, but I will be doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, you just need to send it to Richard, and he'll put it up for you.
Right. Okay, great. Thank you very much, Barbara. And so that's it. Well, let's call it a night, and hopefully everybody can come out again on April 27th. Thanks very much.
Okay.
Good night, everyone.
Good night. Hey, everybody. Bye.